Judge Conley, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Hooten, the Honorable Francis J. Conley presiding.
Thank you. And Ms. Jude, would you turn on your video so you can see us? Great. All right. Good morning. Our final Zoom argument today is case number 823-0028, Lewis et al. Versus Alpine Homes, Inc. As all parties are aware, this is a Zoom argument. This will be available for viewing, I think, tomorrow, but our rules prohibit anyone from making their own private recording, either audio or video. So please respect those rules for those of you who are simply watching in the gallery. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent 15 minutes, then finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So counsel for Alpine Homes, you may begin by just telling us who you are, and then we'll start the clock.
Your Honor, may it please the court, counsel, my name is Ken Bayless, and I represent appellant Alpine Homes. The trial court's decision should be reversed because it acted under a misapprehension of law, overlooked plain and decisive facts, and rendered a decision against logic and the facts on the record. We need to start with the fact that the judgment renewal action itself was untimely because respondent failed to properly serve the summons and complaint within 10 years of the original judgment. The original judgment in this case was January 21, 2010. Minnesota Statute 541.04 requires that judgment be renewed within 10 years. Respondent did not serve the action until after that 10-year deadline passed. The only efforts that respondent made before the 10-year deadline passed was simply to mail some paperwork. This has never been sufficient in Minnesota to initiate any legal cause of action. Serving something by...
In fact, wasn't the summons returned as being non-deliverable to place where she mailed it?
It was, Your Honor, and it was also misaddressed. The address wasn't to the correct address because I think there was a zip code and some other errors. And this occurred more than once. But so it's crystal clear that there was no effort to serve prior to January 21, 2020. Other than these letters that went out. Then in March of 2020, long after the deadline for initiating the action had passed, there's a letter saying that the respondent served the Secretary of State by mail. However, that was never attested to with anything that was in the nature of a sworn affidavit of service in March. But in any event, the March service was 2 months too late. So there simply was no action, and this matter should have just been ended right then and there.
Was the order extend? Oh, I'm sorry. You want to go ahead?
No.
Was the order extending the judgment, was that entered as a default matter?
It was, and I believe it was, and it shouldn't have been, because 541.04 requires that a renewal action be just that, an action. So you have to go through the proper procedures under 541.04 and the accompanying statute to renew that judgment after 10 years.
And Mr. Bayless, let me ask you this. I don't disagree with anything you've said. It seems to me that there are some, you have strong arguments about whether the renewal action was properly commenced. But where does that lead us when what we're reviewing is the district court's decision that in essentially your motion to vacate this judgment as void was untimely?
Well, one of the things the court needs to look to is the Bodie factors. When we consider the timeliness of a motion, we brought the motion, and the Bodie case and the Summers case set forth the different factors that need to be looked at with respect to timeliness, obviously. So if we look at those factors, we find that they all weigh in favor of just adopting the simple approach that the action wasn't commenced timely. For instance, one of the Bodie Summers factors is intervening rights. Has there been something that's occurred between the time of the action being commenced and the time that the party later steps forward and says, hey, you didn't do it right. And here, there's nothing. We argued this in our brief. They've come forward with nothing to show that there was any intervening action between the time of the judgment, which was May of 2020, when it was actually renewed, and the present. What about the next factor, loss of proof? Here, there's no loss of proof. There's nothing that we need to know about what happened as far as the adequacy of the service or whether or not it was properly commenced. Other than that, we know what the mailing situation was. We know what mailings went out when and to whom. So there's no loss of proof question. There's also the question of prejudice. There's no prejudice to them. The deficiency is apparent on its face. The mere fact that they've had to engage in litigation isn't prejudice. And we cited case law in our brief on that point. And finally, there's the question of promptness of taking legal action in response to knowledge of the improper service. And we did that within 2 months of the time that Christosek became aware of the deficiencies in the service and became aware of the fact that the judgment had been renewed. So
did the court consider these factors in its analysis?
The court did not. The court did consider other things that weren't particularly relevant. In its initial order, the court looked to questions of acts that took place before the expiration of the judgment, the initial 10-year judgment. So it's going back and looking at the history of the parties back in 2017 and such. So it seemed to be focused on some of those things that are irrelevant to the timeliness. The court seemed to be impressed by the fact that this goes back, let's say, 12 years now or 13 years. But the reality is it doesn't go back any further than 2020, because the only time at which this issue could have arisen was in 2020, when these deficiencies became apparent on their face.
So the court didn't consider these factors. Should we remand it back so the court can consider these factors?
I don't believe the court should, because I think there is no response to these issues, and it's apparent on its face. How do you argue that there's been any kind of prejudice when we know from looking at the facts of the case that there's no information that's going to be uncovered regarding service that is going to help the respondent get out of the basic problem they have, which is that they didn't commence the renewal action in time. So there's no reason to remand on that particular basis. I'd like to address the standing issue that was raised. Does a defunct corporation have standing to raise these types of issues? And the answer to that question is plainly yes. Statute specifically grants that right. If you look at 302A.783, it says after a corporation has been dissolved, any of its former officers, directors, or shareholders may assert or defend in the name of the corporation. And they can do that with respect to any claim by or against it. So there's a statutory basis for standing. And second of all, it's really kind of odd that we'd have a standing argument here directed against us when we're the party that's being sued in the action. This is unheard of. Standing is usually raised in a situation where a plaintiff is trying to assert a claim against someone, and somebody says, well, you don't have any basis for asserting that claim. This is something totally different.
Mr. Bayless, at this point, your client has been dissolved, doesn't exist.
This is true.
What is the impact of the renewal judgment on a dissolved company like your client is? And I guess maybe that's a different way of me saying, what effective relief would we be giving to your client if we reverse this judgment?
Well, the legislature, in enacting 302A.783, gave us these rights. And I think the court would agree that there is no officer of a defunct corporation that would want any judgment against that defunct corporation in which the officer had participated to be continued. There's no benefit, and there's certainly some detriment to officers having judgments which were entered against it during its viable years later continue or be resurrected subsequently. The legislature recognized that and gave them a statutory basis for this standing. I'd also like to address the question of collateral estoppel and whether or not issues that are subject to the second order were already addressed in the first one? And the answer is that they were not. The only paragraph of the court's first order that arguably addresses anything related to the adequacy of service, which was plainly inadequate, was paragraph 3, where it says the action was commenced, and then it goes about reciting the history of the various mailings that took place. But the court never reaches down and starts analyzing, well, is that sufficient or isn't it? The court just doesn't address it. And when
there was no appeal taken from that, isn't sort of that the law of the case? I mean, isn't that just established? I don't think you have to go to collateral estoppel to say the court has made the decision that this was commenced and nobody challenged that on appeal.
A couple points. First, the trial court didn't expressly rule on collateral estoppel grounds, but I'm raising it because it was raised in respondent's brief. Second point, if you look at the law we cited in our brief, court looks to the question of was this something that the court really addressed in the earlier order? If the court really addressed it, then collateral estoppel might apply. But if essentially the court was ruling on other grounds, then it doesn't apply. And in this situation, we had the court limiting its first order to the question of whether or not there was standing or whether or not the homeowners association could intervene in the dispute. And the court said the homeowners could not intervene in the dispute. And that was the basis for that first ruling. So it didn't really rule on those issues. So that doesn't provide a basis for collateral estoppel. And we have a section of our brief on that that discusses those various issues. On the question of timeliness, I'd point out that this action was commenced within 2 months of the time that Christosek found out about it. So once he found out about it, he acted promptly to vindicate those rights.
But the judge said he should have known, or his attorneys probably knew about this before. And so that's how the judge discounted that testimony.
Right.
Because they're the same attorneys as the homeowners association.
Right. The homeowners.
Or motion.
The homeowners. Christosek found out through the homeowners association, but the mere fact that you have the same attorneys doesn't mean that your client has the knowledge that a different client had. So that basis isn't sufficient on which to deny the motion. We'd ask that the court reverse the decision below and vacate the judgment.
As to the reasonableness of the time that the motion was brought, do we defer to the district court on that?
Well, I don't think we do when the court hasn't really provided any analysis of any intervening rights, any loss of proof, any prejudice, and on its face, it's obvious that none of those things exist. The bottom line.
Is there anything in the record so that would support any of those factors?
Well, I think the basic facts of how service was attempted to be accomplished here is sufficient to definitively establish beyond any doubt that those factors all must weigh in favor of the appellant, because we know there's not going to be intervening rights and loss of proof and prejudice when they haven't initiated the action promptly, because that was determined as of the date that they should have serve the action.
Could I ask you this? Was there ever any argument regarding the statute that applies here regarding the renewal of the judgment? I mean, was there any argument regarding the applicability of that statute, or that it would, in this case, render the renewal order void? Was that ever an issue?
Yes. Well, the statute is the basis for the renewal action. There's a 10-year limitations on renewing a judgment, and you have to do it by action, and that's what the statute says, and that's what the Shamrock case says. I don't think there was really any dispute that that 10-year statute is the limitation that would apply. They've tried to argue that because this is a confession of judgment case, that doesn't apply. But this particular confession of judgment doesn't provide that the renewal action doesn't need to go through proper process. And the confession of judgment just says that it applies to the action, which is talking about the initial action. So when they came to that 10-year period, what they needed to do was commence an action and serve the parties as one would normally serve a lawsuit in order to initiate it.
And just so I'm clear, that the record does not show any attempt by anyone to vacate the original judgment. Am I correct? It's just this renewal of judgment order that is the subject of the motions to vacate. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. We know that that initial judgment expires after 10 years. So the initial judgment, if it isn't renewed, it goes away.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you. This is Janice Jude on behalf of Bradley Lewis and the other plaintiffs in this matter. I'd like to start by just saying that the trial court ruled in this matter that the appellant's motion was untimely, that the doctrine of collateral estoppel did apply, and that appellant had no standing in this matter. Those should be the only issues before the court today. I would also like to point out just a few irregularities in this matter that make this case somewhat different or unique. First of all, it is a judgment renewal. It's not a new civil case. It's not a new judgment case. And there aren't specific rules in the statutes that set forth the procedures for a judgment renewal.
Well, actually, we have a statute, don't we? I mean, I'm looking at the statute and I'm not reading any ambiguity here. It says no action shall be maintained upon a judgment or decree of the court of the United States of any state or territory thereof, unless begun, and I assume that's modifying action, within 10 years after the entry of such judgment. So the legislature's spoken on this, haven't they? And doesn't this control?
That is correct, except that it doesn't set forth how to go about that, that it's a
I think it's pretty clear that you have to begin an action. Isn't that correct?
It says to commence an action, correct?
Right, and commencing an action includes getting adequate service of the opposing party, correct?
Correct, but how you go about that it's been prescribed by case law, but there's not a specific situation, or there's not a specific rule that says it's a brand new action. That's my only point on it, that there's not specific, it doesn't say a summons and complaint must be served. It doesn't set forth the exact procedures on how to go about it.
All right, but you will concede, will you not, that you in order to commence an action, you have to serve the opposing party.
Correct.
And pursuant to this statute, that service has to take place within that 10-year period. Am I correct?
Correct.
And that did not happen here. Am I correct on that as well?
I would not necessarily agree with that, but what I would say is that that's not what is at issue here.
Well, I'm just looking at the Bodie case, and one thing we have to look at is whether the judge had the authority to even extend it after it expired by operation of law. Isn't that what we're looking at here?
Well, under the
and then looking at the exceptions to set forth in voting, one of them is whether the court had any authority to even enter this order.
What I read as the Bodie factors, it specifically states several things, not specifically limited to the intervening rights, the loss of proof, or prejudice to the adverse party. What it says is that the trial court must consider the reasonable timeliness based on all circumstances, such as those things, but also the commanding equities of the case, the desirability that judgments be final, and other relevant factors. And it's our position that the appellant failed to analyze the equities of the case along with the other relevant factors and specific facts of this matter, and instead dismisses the trial court's analysis, where the trial court does set forth additional relevant factors that she based her decision on, as well as the commanding equities of this particular case.
Would you, under Bodie, consider this to be a direct attack rather than a collateral attack by Alpine?
Yes.
All right. So that Rule 60.02 was the correct method to attack it. Am I correct?
Correct.
And in looking at the facts in Bodie, there was literally 18 years between the time of the judgment and the time they were attacking that judgment. Am I correct? And there'd been a whole host of litigation and reliance by the parties and the court on the assumption that the court had adequate jurisdiction. Am I correct?
Yes. All right. You're referring to the Bodie case, correct?
Right. Yes. And prior to Bodie, in a case like this where the judgment had been void and there had been the court had no power to enter the judgment, there was no time limit on when you could bring a motion to vacate for lack of jurisdiction. Yes. Am I correct?
Correct.
So Bodie did change the law in that area.
Correct, but there still has to be the reasonableness.
Well, except one statement. I mean, didn't Bodie, though, indicate that there may be in modifying the law, they said there can be extraordinary circumstances where, you know, where such modification of the law, that you can bring it at any time, can be modified. Can be vacated. Isn't that what Bodie said? I mean, they said this is one of those cases where it's extraordinary circumstances. We've got 18 years of high-scale litigation based on the assumption that everyone thought the judge had no authority, or the judge had the authority to make these decisions. Doesn't that distinguish this case from Bodie under those extraordinary circumstances that they referenced?
Yes, I would say that this case is different. Our current case is different in the fact that the validity of the judgment was never challenged. It was confessed to in 2009 and considered to be valid for this entire time period.
Well, except in Bodie, these weren't default judgments. This was a default order that was entered, and there the parties all assumed there was jurisdiction, and there was no dispute about that until 18 years after the fact. Am I correct?
True. Correct.
All right. In this case, we have a party that was never that. Never had notice or certainly wasn't served till after the order had been entered.
Which then
the default judgment, right?
Correct. But in this circumstance, this defendant was dissolved, had been dissolved for several years. And so, of course, that wasn't known at the time service was attempted prior to the deadline on the judgment renewal. But when that was discovered and served upon the Secretary of State, under the fact that he was dissolved, he never would have received notice anyway and would have no reason to intervene in this or object to it.
But there was nothing prohibiting. I mean, you'd had 10 years with this judgment. Was there anything prohibiting you from serving the Secretary of State and making that determination within that 10-year period?
No, except that it wasn't known at the time service was attempted upon Alpine Homes that it was in fact dissolved.
But it would have been
discovered.
You could have checked with the Secretary of State.
I guess I could have. I had no reason to think that it was dissolved at the time of attempting to serve, and it wasn't until only one of the pieces of mail was returned, that it was discovered that Alpine was dissolved.
Well, let's go ahead.
Can I just ask this one question? Assuming that the 2020 judgment is void for improper service, and I'm not saying we're deciding that, and there obviously is contention around that. If that is true, does that make a difference in terms of your argument that the district court's denial of the motion to vacate should stand?
I guess I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, I think your argument is that under Bodie, that the request for this court to evaluate whether that judgment is void, or for the district court to evaluate whether that judgment was void, Alpine doesn't get to make that argument because they didn't ask to do so within a reasonable amount of time.
Correct.
What made the 2-year delay here unreasonable? What are the most critical facts that you would point to as supporting the district court's denial of the motion?
Well, I think timeliness, or untimeliness rather, is only one piece of it. What should have happened is that our position is that this is the association just utilizing Alpine Homes to take another swing at this judgment. The association feigned not having any knowledge of this judgment or the judgment renewal, yet the trial court found that they did in fact have knowledge of it based on the facts and affidavits that were submitted. The court did in fact rule on the association's motions that they were untimely, and did rule on the service issue within that order. It was at that point in time that should have been appealed. What is not in front of the court now is the service. What is in front of the court is whether Alpine acted in a timely manner, whether Alpine has any standing in this matter, and whether collateral estoppel applies. And that's what the trial court held, was that they didn't have any standing. There is no impact to Alpine whatsoever with this judgment standing. Alpine conveyed its interest in the real estate that the judgment affects back in 2017 and dissolved and moved out of state and has absolutely no impact to them. There's no injury that Alpine can allege regarding this judgment. It is the association's motion that should have been appealed, and they should have notified or brought in Alpine at that time. What this case truly highlights and demonstrates is actually the association's failures. And this is just one more attempt for them to try to get rid of this judgment that they knowingly took on.
Well, can I ask you, counsel's argued that the judge didn't apply the factors as set forth in Bodie, and that because of that, she erred as a matter of law by failing to apply those factors, and that it was up to that these factors were not shown or considered by the court. How do you respond to that argument?
And what I would say is that the Bodie factors aren't limited to the things that a counsel cites to. It says the court must consider all circumstances, such as intervening rights, loss of proof, or prejudice to an adverse party, commanding equities of the case, and desirability that judgments be final, and other relevant factors. And I would argue that the trial court did, in fact, address other relevant actors, did on other relevant factors, excuse me, as well as the specific facts of this particular matter. So I would say that the Bodie factors aren't limited to just those three items that counsel addresses. The appellant did on page 27 of its brief argue that the trial court's ruling on the association's motion were erroneous and that the court made erroneous statements. But that's not an issue here, and that's not relevant to this appeal, except that it further highlights that this is actually the association utilizing Alpine to take another shot at this judgment. And the appellant offered no satisfactory reason why it didn't bring its motion until 2.5 years after this judgment renewal was entered. And so our position is that for all the reasons stated within my brief and on the record here, that respondent requests that the trial court's order be affirmed based on the timeliness, the no standing, and the doctrine of collateral estoppel does in fact apply.
How do you respond to the arguments of counsel regarding the standing issues? That because the officers can still be ascertained that they nonetheless have standing with regard to this judgment.
And again, this is a unique set of circumstances. I acknowledge that it is different for a defendant to not have standing, but Minnesota law doesn't limit standing to apply to just plaintiffs, and the facts are unique here. Because what standing applies to is whether the party has a stake in the outcome of the matter or if it can allege any injury. And it's our position that the appellant here cannot allege any injury. The appellant initially confessed to this judgment in 2009.
But what difference does that make? If there's a judgment against an entity that can still be sued under the law, even though it's dissolved, why doesn't that give them a stake in the case to provide standing? I don't understand that.
Well, there's no injury to Alpine as a result of this.
Well, actually, the injury, though, is the fact that the judge, who had no authority under the law, entered an extension of an expired judgment. That's their injury, isn't it? I mean, that's a pretty big deal.
He has essentially conveyed his interest in that judgment, however, to the association.
Well, he quit claim some property, but that doesn't mean he's not still on the hook.
His name may be attached to it. Alpine Homes' name may be attached to it, but he doesn't have any injury. He doesn't have, the judgment is against the real estate at this point, and it is the association that stands to have an injury because they're going to have to address this judgment.
Well, But that in and of itself, I mean, the plaintiff still would have rights against Alpine.
There's nothing left of Alpine. It is dissolved, and they've dissolved themselves by conveying their interest in the judgment to the association. It is the association that is attempting now to act through Alpine Homes.
Well, then why do you even want to? You know, why did you even want to renew the judgment then?
Because it can be enforced against the real estate that is owned by the association, which will be the next step to be able to foreclose on that.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bayless, you'll have the last word, sir. Mr. Bayless, you're not muted.
Counsel stated that the statute doesn't say it's a brand new action, but it does. It says that it shall be commenced by action. And if you read the statute in conjunction with the Shamrock case, it's clear that in Minnesota, if you're going to renew a judgment, you need to do it with a separate legal action. So that assertion is simply wrong. With respect to Bodie, Bodie was a substantially different situation where, as the court noted, more than a decade had passed. And a deadline had been missed early on in the process of an appeal. And one of the parties had actually participated in that appeal that had taken place more than a decade ago. And they kind of held it in their back pocket for more than a decade. And there were intervening rights because that action had effects through the years on other parties, so that there was some kind of intervening changes and there was prejudice. And that highlights the difference between the present case and the Bodie case. With respect to the standing argument, the statute gives the standing that's necessary. And counsel hasn't come forward with a single case in Minnesota where the doctrine of standing has been applied against a defendant who has been sued, which doesn't make sense to apply the doctrine in that context. As far as one more attempt is concerned, the reality is that as soon as this was discovered, the HOA brought its motion. The court said, I'm not going to let you intervene. And I'm not going to let you intervene because it's really the interest of Alpine Homes. And then at that point, Alpine Homes intervenes and they say, well, this is just one more attempt. It's kind of ironic that they're saying that when we reacted initially and they opposed our motion to intervene. So unless the court has any additional questions, I'd rest on.
I had one question. You know, in terms of the Findon factors in your reply brief, you reference, you know, that you have a meritorious defense and you cite to Charson v. Temple Israel and Northland Temporaries Incorporated. Were either of those cases statute of limitation defense cases? Do you know?
Your Honor, I simply don't know, Your Honor.
Okay. Because I'm just concerned, you know, when I generally think of a defense on the merits, I think of, you know, we didn't owe the money, you know, we didn't do it, something like that. And I'm just wondering if statute of limitations counts as a is a defense on the merits. Why should we think that's a defense on the merits?
Well, I think the if you look at the case law that applies to 60.02D void judgments, you'll find that those cases assume that it's a void judgment if there wasn't personal jurisdiction or if there wasn't a statute of limitations issue that's being applied.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't think we have any more questions. So we thank counsel for the appellant, counsel for the respondent. We will be issuing our decision within 90 days. That being our last oral argument, we are adjourned.